It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Noah Ovshinsky, in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up later on the program, we'll talk about yesterday's shooting at a D.C. Navy yard. Our guest says that despite the casualties, we shouldn't expect national legislation anytime soon.
But first, this is the part of the show each week where we geek out about something or look back on something nostalgic in our past. And this week we found something that combines a bit of both.
Comic books are an iconic part of American culture. Over time, what started as cheap entertainment for kids evolved into an art form of its own and gave us the superhero as well.
But older comics have a problem. They were printed on cheap, acidic paper that deteriorates over time. And that means comics from the golden and silver ages of comic book production are destined to fall apart.
And that did not sit well with John Sindel. So he set to work developing a method to preserve these comics for well into the future. And this led him to start the Q Collection Comic Book Preservation Project. And he's here now to tell us about it. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So let's get right into it. John, what got you interested in comic book preservation?
Back in 2001, I purchased a comic book called the 1939 World's Fair comic. There's only 75 copies of that known to exist. And when I got it and tried to turn a page, the page fell apart. And so I sent it to a restoration specialist, Matt Nelson, and he emailed me when he received it, and he said, the only thing you can do with this comic is stick it in a drawer and forget about it. And I was really upset, and so I said, well, what about all comic books? He says, well, they're all going to have the same problem. He said, they're all going to be gone in 100 to 200 years. He says, there's nothing we can do about it, so we let it go.
Do people care about comic book preservation? I mean, you hear about preserving, you know, the great works of literature, important documents. Has this kind of been off people's radar?
It has in America, but it hasn't been internationally, which has really surprised me, because so many Americans are dead set against what I'm doing, and yet I've got 26 advisors who reside in 19 countries. Hmm. So people like one of my advisors is in Slovenia, one in South Africa, Japan, New Zealand, all over the world. They're enthused about it. And these are professors and academics, writers, and artists.
Why would people be against preserving these comic books?
Because they believe I'm destroying them.
By preserving them? Explain
yes,
that.
Because in order to preserve them, I have to cut them up. And then I have to cook them using a Mylar UV-resistant laminate. And I cook them at a high temperature and melt the Mylar into each page. And then I cut them to fit and put them into special binders.
I can see why that would be hard for people who love comic books when you say you have to cut them up and cook them. But we have an example of what you did to preserve a comic book, a Dick Tracy super comic. And you know, it looks beautiful and looks like it's going to stand the test of time. Are people convinced when they see what you've done?
When they see it, yes. But a lot of people are very hard-headed. And the idea of taking a comic that's worth thousands of dollars and changing it so it's worth nothing. And my entire collection is now worth nothing. So they think, you know, to me, it should never be a commodity. It should be a source of imagination and entertainment.
I mean, there are a lot of comic books out there. And I went through my garage a few months ago and I found a box of my very old comic books that had been sitting on the garage floor, cement floor, for over a year now, with moisture and different temperatures and things like that. They're not in good shape. They're also comic books that I don't think are really collectibles or they're not comic books people are, I don't think, going to miss. What criteria does a comic book have to meet, you know, to be included or that you would consider to use your process with?
Well, I refer to these as key comic books, and that's generally considered important if it's the first issue of a series or the first appearance of an important new character within that series, revising of an existing character for a new comic book age, such as the Silver Age, or an origin issue, or maybe a classic cover. I'll give you an example. I recently picked up a copy of All Negro Comics number 1 from 1947. There are between 10 and 20 copies of that comic known to exist. It's extremely expensive. When I got it, I could not turn a page because it was suffering from dry rot. So I laminated every page, and I had to use a spatula to get each page into a laminating pouch. And then I cooked them. And now you can read them cover to cover. You can do anything you want with them. They cannot be hurt.
So do you have any regrets about doing this? I mean, you said your comic book collection would be worth a lot of money. I don't know how much, if you're willing to tell us, but now you've done this. You've said it's worth nothing. Any regrets about that?
I got some figures for you just for fun. Right now there are 215 key comic books in the collection. If they were all in mint condition, they'd be worth $5,470,845.
And you cut them up?
Well, they weren't in that condition when I bought them because my project is a rescue mission. So I go for comics between poor and good grade. And if they were in a poor to good grade and not cut up, they'd probably be worth between $150,000 and $200,000.
Now, you're worried about posterity here. You're not worried about, you know, the $5 million you're losing out on.
Well, I don't have any kids, so I'm not going to leave any money to them. And they don't have any kids because they don't exist. I have one nephew, and he's the richest guy in the family, and I'm hoping he'll leave me money. But the thing is, what about stuff that I buy? So what? If when I die, what's going to be left? Stuff for somebody else? It doesn't matter. But when I die and I've left this with the Library of Congress, there's something that is going to provide entertainment and a source for historians for thousands of years.
Does the Smithsonian approve of what you've done with these comics? Are they interested in your method?
The Library of Congress. The Library of Congress, I've been in touch with them, and I've worked with Georgia Higley, and she's in charge of that section. They only began buying comic books in 1950. Right now they have 100,000 comics, but they don't have the comics that I do because they're too rare and too difficult to get hold of. A lot of the comics that I have were never for sale. They were only sold to me under condition they'd be used in this project. So they would never be able to get them even at the Library of Congress. And their advisor, Robert Bierbaum, is also one of my advisors. So he knows what they have and what they don't have.
We've talked about the the physical, degrading of these comic books that time and perhaps poor storage brings to them. But what about the different ways people are experiencing comic books, or the differences in technology that kids and young adults are dealing with today? They've got the web, and they've got all these options when it comes to media. Is comic book consumption still relevant? And what does that mean for your project?
Right now, there's approximately 300,000 collectors just in the United States. And there are probably millions worldwide. America's consumption of comic books is tiny compared with, say, Japan. But the thing is, you said the key word, today. Not tomorrow, not the day after, not the day after that. It's like an 8-track player or a record player that plays only 16 2/3 revolutions per minute. So what happens when technology changes? Do you think these scans that they're putting on digitalizing right now are going to last? Maybe in 100 years, probably not in 500. And as for 10,000, no, they're not going to be around, and people won't have a clue what they are. Only hard copies will still exist. They're the only guarantee.
Well, the comic book is such a huge icon of American culture, even though there's only not quite as many collectors here as you said there are in Japan. But it does sound like there's this international interest surrounding your collection in particular. How did you get such interest in it from around the world?
I had an article that was done in the International Journal of Comic Art, and that was done last fall. And that goes all over the world. And I was suggested by the publisher that I should get in contact, and gave me a few names. I did that, and they in turn suggested, there's somebody in Slovenia, or there's somebody in France that you should get in touch with. And I started doing that, and one by one, I gathered until at 26, I had to say, that's enough advisors. 19 countries pretty much span the globe.
That's quite a few. John, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for putting up with me.
It was easy. John Sindel is the founder of the Q Collection Comic Book Preservation Project.
Yesterday's shooting at the Washington Navy Yard left 13 dead, including the gunman.
It marks the 20th mass killing in the United States since President Obama took office. In total, 174 people have been killed since January 2009.
Despite these figures, our next guest says we shouldn't expect any new gun restrictions anytime soon.
Philip Bump joins us to outline why that is. He's a writer for the Atlantic Wire, and his latest article is Diminishing Returns, Why the D.C. Shooting Won't Lead to New Gun Laws. And just so you know, we've linked to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Philip, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
After yesterday's tragedy, you know, lawmakers might find it to be a good time. I think lawmakers or people who certainly are in favor of gun control would probably find it a good time to renew the call for gun reform. But Obama, for example, didn't bring it up in his remarks yesterday. Why not?
I think that Congress had learned a very severe lesson when they tried to do this in the wake of the Newtown massacre last December. As I'm sure everyone remembers, over the course of this spring, the Senate tried to pass a package of bills that would apply some limited form of gun control and also other measures, you know, background checks and so on and so forth, and it was unable to do so. The Senate, of course, being the more liberal body on Capitol Hill. And I think that if this incident had occurred outside of the context of that recent effort and outside of the context of Newtown, there would be a stronger push. And, you know, we've seen today some small mentions of trying to do something. But in that context, I think that it's essentially a non-starter.
Speaking of Newtown, yesterday Fox News commentator Britt Hume had this to say about the shooting.
I think a lot of the usual suspects have gone to battle stations, as they always do, over gun control or the lack of it or whatever, but and that's going to happen, but it doesn't mean very much at this stage. Hard to believe that after what happened in Newtown, nothing came of it in Congress. Much of a night issue is going to come of this.
First, how significant is it that nothing came of the shooting in Newtown, as he put it?
I think it's tremendously significant. I mean, I think that, you know, there were a number of factors about Newtown that made it more shocking than a lot of these other incidents. And you pointed out the fact that, you know, there have been more such mass killings under Obama than under any other recent president, according to data compiled by Mother Jones Magazine. And, you know, that suggests that these things have become sort of routine. Newtown broke us out of that routine. It was the murder in an elementary school of small children, and it was absolutely stunning. And I think everyone remembers that. But even in the wake of that, there was complete paralysis on Capitol Hill. Yesterday's event, which involved a man with apparent mental health problems, as the news report just suggested, who was attacking people in a workplace, which we've seen before, it is a routine incident in a pattern of routines that makes it far less likely that there will be the same sort of energy that comes out of the response.
You talk about paralysis in Congress. Where does the paralysis come from?
Well, the paralysis is not specific to gun control, of course. This is according to information, or according to, I believe it's Open Government, the website that tracks the number of bills that have happened over the course of each Congress. This has been the least productive Congress to date of any Congress in recent memory. So the paralysis exists outside of the context of gun control, and that's many people assume that is a function of the fact that Congress has grown more partisan. Gun control was, especially with a president that was coming off a re-election that he won handily, it was expected that, you know, maybe gun control could be a sort of thing that people rallied around, and they just rallied against it.
So speaking of folks who did rally around it to some extent, certainly in the state level, two Democratic state legislators in Colorado recently lost their seats in recall elections, partly over the issue of gun control in that state. Do you think other politicians have their eye on the Colorado, what's happening in Colorado? And is that a warning signal for them?
There's no question about it. The NRA, which is always a very smart political actor, was tremendously smart in the way that they focused on taking out these legislators in Colorado. And, you know, that was 1 week ago today that two legislators who took a risky vote in a Democratic but not overwhelmingly Democratic state legislature lost their jobs because of the vote they took on gun control. And for elected officials who always need to have some sort of political cover to make the decisions that they do, either coming from, you know, mass popular support or from, you know, having peers on their body that also vote the same way they do, it makes it much harder for legislators, I think probably at every level of government, to feel bold about taking action on gun control, knowing that pushing for gun control measures has not been successful. But when you are successful, there is a real political cost.
Now, when we talk about Colorado and what happened there with the recalls, was it just, you know, Coloradoans involved in this? Were there outside groups? Did they come in? Did other outside groups see these recall elections as an opportunity, or is this just playing out in Colorado?
No, I mean this became a national issue. You know, Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York, who has an organization called Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which has put a new emphasis on gun control measures, put a lot of money into the race, as did a number of other external organizations. The NRA actually put in less, if I'm remembering correctly, right, about the same amount as did Bloomberg's group. But the NRA had something that they didn't, which was on the ground organizing. There are a lot of NRA members all across the country, and you know what the Denver Post, as it was giving its story on what was happening in the election on the day of the election, used as its header image a man who was, you know, holding up a big sign saying, you know, vote no on these legislators, essentially. And it mentioned as an aside that he was an NRA member. So they had people they could count on to actually do some of that field work. And for them, they probably didn't need to spend a lot of money anyway.
So Michael Bloomberg is a big city mayor. And a lot of the folks involved in gun control issues are from larger cities. Do you think this debate over gun control and frankly, the lack of gun control since Sandy Hook, do you think that can be at least partly explained by this growing rural-urban divide?
It's a good question. And honestly, I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to look at data in order to be able to say with certainty. But, you know, I mean, I think that there is a divide in the national legislature, which is reflected along partisan lines, but, you know, also mirrors a number of other trends, such as the fact that, you know, there is growing diversity in America and that people of color tend to vote more Democratic, that there is, you know, an increased split. You know, there are more people living in cities than before. That also tends to indicate particular demography and political associations. And so there is this increasing bifurcation in Congress, and I think it is as much a reflection of that as anything.
Coincidentally, Senator Dick Durbin was set to have a hearing today examining stand your ground laws, which have been very controversial. What did his decision to postpone that hearing suggest to you? What did it say to you?
Stand your ground is interesting because, I mean, everyone became familiar with stand your ground, obviously, in the wake of the Trayvon Martin case in Florida, and the idea that people should be empowered to act with deadly force if they feel as though their lives are threatened. If, you know, the hearing went forward, obviously it's difficult to have a conversation about a subcomponent of, you know, gun laws at the same time that people are still literally cleaning up a crime scene several miles away. I think it was a tricky moment to have that conversation, but there was definitely some frustration expressed by people who were coming to Washington to testify on this issue, who felt as though there was little that could be more ironic than having a hearing about addressing gun violence be postponed because of gun violence.
I mean, Congress presumably is elected by the people. You know, that we're the source of the power in Congress. Is the American public, the voting public, becoming too desensitized to the issue of gun violence, you know, as a result of all these shootings?
I mean, the word "too" there obviously is subjective depending on how you feel about gun control measures. But I think it is clearly the case that Americans are less outraged by, you know, what is now run-of-the-mill gun violence than they were at one point in time. You know, I mean, the fact that, yesterday's violence, which obviously got a lot of media attention, still doesn't seem to have had the same sort of saturation as something like Newtown, which, as I said before, you know, had some unique characteristics which made it something that was truly deeply shocking. The fact that a man can walk into a naval base and you just don't see that same level of shock, I think is remarkable, and I think is something that people who are advocating for gun control measures obviously would feel somewhat nervous about.
We're talking with Philip Bump about his article in the Atlantic Wire, Diminishing Returns, Why the D.C. Shooting Won't Lead to New Gun Laws.
And we invite you to join the conversation. Do you agree with Philip, or do you think we might be at a tipping point? Are you concerned that events like this might be desensitizing us to gun violence? Call 1-800-642-1234.
And this is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Noah Ovshinsky.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Philip Bump, a writer for the Atlantic Wire, about why he thinks yesterday's Naval Yard shooting won't lead to new gun legislation.
And we invite you to join the conversation. Are new gun laws the solution to the problem of mass shootings in the United States? If not, what should the solution be? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can also leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. So returning to our conversation, Philip, I want to talk a little bit about Congress. I want to return to Congress. And based on your reporting and what you know, what would need to change? Not what needs to change, but what would need to change in order for there to be some kind of reform of any kind in today's Congress, whether we're talking about gun control, the farm bill, the deficit, you name it.
I mean, politics is the act of representing constituencies, and there are, you know, I mean, there are a majority of Republicans in Congress, or in the House, rather, that has a certain set of priorities. There's a majority of Democrats in the Senate that has a different set of priorities. Those sets of priorities are increasingly divergent, and I think that for either side to want to see some sort of change, you know, either both sides need to be willing to compromise, or the voters need to change their elected representatives. I think that the overwhelming evidence that exists out there is that the Republican Party has been more obstinate in sticking to its goals of what it wants to achieve. You know, it is set to embark on its 41st straight attempt to defund or otherwise undermine the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, which is, you know, this they've held a number of votes this year, even while things such as funding the government have fallen by the wayside. The problem, such as it is that there is a group of elected officials, and this is how they are acting, and that, you know, the nature of democracy is that if you don't like that, then you change your elected officials.
We're going to go to the phones now, and we invite you to join the conversation. You know, are new gun laws the solution to the problem of mass shootings? Should something be done? John in Rib Lake, what do you think?
Well, a follow-up to the comment just made by the guest with regard to, you know, changing our legislators, I think that be it with regard to guns or really anything with our government, the general public, I think, seems to just have become so apathetic. And I think the reason for that is we seem powerless because no matter who we put into these offices, they're controlled by people who have a whole bunch of money, and therefore they're going to be the legislators are beholden to them, and not to us as the voters, the electorate. And so, until the money is out of the question, I see no solution.
Philip, what role do you see money in playing all this? Obviously, there's been changes due to recent Supreme Court rulings that have allowed more money and different kinds of money into our election system. What role does money play in the paralysis?
It's a great point, and I think one that tends to be oversimplified, and I don't mean to be disparaging in saying that, but you know, the way that lobbyists and organizations use money is not quite the direct sort of patronage that is generally interpreted. You know, the people buy access to fundraisers, people buy access to meetings and build actual personal relationships with elected officials that allows them then to have their viewpoint heard. You know, one of the challenges that people who advocate for, you know, working class folks have is that it is harder for them to get that sort of access. And so, you know, if you are, for example, an environmental group and you want to present your case to an elected official, you know, the odds are good that Exxon has been able to get a lot more meetings than you have just by virtue of that sort of relationship. You know, this is obviously, I'm painting with a very, very broad brush there, but I think that the relationship is not quite as tight as people suggest that it is. Regardless, you know, I mean, the fact that elected officials have a lot of decisions to make on a lot of different things and hear some voices more loudly than others is itself obviously a problem.
Yeah. Going back to the phones, Paul from Elkhorn, what do you think?
Well, all the mass shootings that have occurred recently, as a matter of fact, pretty much all the mass shootings in the early 70s, have occurred in what's quote-unquote been the gun-free zones. So no one, a bad guy is not dumb enough to go into a place where he knows heavily armed people are going to be able to defend themselves and open fire. I mean, that's what happened at Newtown and what happened at Aurora, and that's what happened at the naval base. The only people that were armed were the security guards, and they took 7 minutes to respond. So, I mean, in addition, gun violence has actually gone down in the last 20 years. It's just that we've sensationalized these isolated cases, even though it's been three times in the last year, it's these isolated cases of quote-unquote mass murder. And all of these cases have also been mental health related. So that's mm-hmm. the issue, in my mind, not the guns.
So, Paul, obviously, you know, we've been talking about the paralysis in Congress and the inability of Congress to come up with really any comprehensive direction towards gun control. Do you think Congress is on the right track?
No, I think they're not on the right track. I think they should relax the gun laws because we have 20,000 gun laws in this country. And as shown in Milwaukee, they plea bargain gun crimes down to littering or jaywalking. So they aren't enforcing the ones they have in effect today. So, I mean, additional laws, if they're not enforced, and additional laws, if they're not well thought out, do no good.
And Philip, you know, we've heard from several Wisconsinites here from really across the state, and obviously they represent a variety of viewpoints. Looking outside our borders for a second, the Washington Post recently noted that, you know, foreigners say they are no longer surprised at U.S. gun violence. What does that say about our image?
Well, I mean, I honestly, I don't think it says much about our image that we're not already familiar with. I mean, we've been the land of the cowboys for a long time. But I do want to go back to some of the points that the last caller made, because quite honestly, some of the things that he said are factually inaccurate. It is not everyone who commits one of these crimes that has a mental health problem, for example. I mean, obviously you can judge for yourself the mental health of someone who decides to murder a bunch of people, but in terms of diagnosed actual mental health afflictions, it is, I think, something like two-thirds of the ones have demonstrated something like that prior to the actual act. Also, this recurring idea that these only happen in gun-free zones is also incorrect. You know, Jared Loughner, who shot Gabby Giffords in Tucson, Arizona, did this outside of a grocery store. You know, I mean, there are any number of examples. There was a shooting that happened at an apartment complex in Washington State. There's a shooting that happened at a nail salon in Georgia. I mean, these things happen all over the place all the time, not just in these I know no one there is going to have a gun areas. And it's a common talking point. It's a false talking point, and I think it's worth addressing.
I want to, Philip, I just want to ask you one last question. Putting your hands on the crystal ball for a second, do you see the paralysis continuing in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, categorically, yes. I mean, you know, there is at this point, particularly given the fact that, you know, as I say in the article, President Obama is about as politically weak as he's been since he took office, if not the politically weakest, particularly in the aftermath of the Syria vote, or the call for a Syria vote, and that has empowered his opponents both in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party. And I think that for the short term, this is going to be the case. There was a member of Congress that spoke with the Washington Post, I believe it was yesterday, who said that he'd never seen both sides of the aisle being so leaderless, both the Democrats from Barack Obama and the fact that the Republicans are so willing to stand up to John Boehner in the House, and that portends ongoing inability to get stuff done.
Well, we'll leave it there. Philip, thanks for being with us today.
Of course, my pleasure.
Philip Bump is a writer for the Atlantic Wire. His article, Diminishing Returns, Why the D.C. Shooting Won't Lead to New Gun Laws, is linked on the Central Time website and Facebook page. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was ousted by popular demand on January 25th of 2011. But that was hardly the end of the conflict and protests in Egypt.
Although the media moved its attention to Syria and then other parts of the world, protests and violence continued in Egypt, and President Mohamed Morsi struggled to form a cohesive government.
When Morsi was taken into military custody earlier this summer, violence broke out, and Egypt's narrative of a successful revolution and transition into a democracy came into serious question.
Vice President and co-founder of Global Post, Charles Sennett, has been reporting on the events in Egypt since the revolution began over 2.5 years ago. And his frontline documentary, Egypt in Crisis, airs on Wisconsin Public Television at 9 o'clock tonight. Charles, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you were there at the beginning of the Arab Spring in Egypt. What did you see then?
Well, I think everyone remembers those days in early 2011 when there were millions of people gathering in Tahrir Square. Tahrir means Liberation Square. So it was really a powerful rallying point for what was called the Facebook revolution, if you remember, and all these young people online coordinating, pulling together, and suddenly, you know, I've covered the Middle East for more than 25 years, but when I watched that, I saw something I thought I'd never see, which was people power, a pro-democracy movement, toppling Hosni Mubarak, who had ruled Egypt very brutally, a great deal of corruption as a police state, which you know, we should be embarrassed to know that it was, of course, very strongly backed by the United States. And here it was being toppled, and relatively peaceful demonstrations. Yes, there was violence. There were deaths. It wasn't all pretty. The deaths were mostly caused by the military and police cracking down, mostly police cracking down on the crowd. But if you sum it all up, it was a historic turning point. It was really at the height of the Arab Spring, the height of optimism, and nothing could have been further away from that hope than what we saw this summer.
It is incredible looking back, because watching from afar on television the way most Americans did, it did seem like this incredible breakthrough moment. There's even a shot of you in this documentary smiling while you're watching a protest singer, and you can tell that you felt and the people there felt like you were witnessing something historic and monumental and very hopeful fundamentally. But that's not exactly what happened. What happened next?
Well, you know, that yes, you're right. The film really is about a journey of this team from Frontline and Global Post. Cameraman Tim Grugia, who's an amazing shooter, and the producer Martin Smith, and our field producers Mohamed Sabri and others. We all were absolutely enraptured, I guess you'd have to say, by this very positive feeling of a revolution unfolding before your eyes. And what's happened is different, but I want to stress the idea that as dispiriting as the events of this summer were, as it descended into violence, as the popularly elected president, the first president elected in free and fair elections in 5,000 years, was forced out in a coup, put under detention in an undisclosed location. Despite all of that, I still think that kernel of hope, that yearning for democracy, is there on the streets of Cairo. And one of the big challenges for American foreign policy, and really for everyone, is how do you take that energy and how do you allow it to go forward to really become a true democracy in a country where faith, Islam, is very important to the vast majority of the people, and that they want their leaders to be informed by their faith? Can Islam survive in a democratic setting. How does democracy include the Islamists, but not exclude the Christian minority or exclude women? And I think America owes it to Egypt, if I could be so bold. I'm not usually so editorial about these things, but I've spent a lot of time there, and I really think it's a fair assertion that we owe it to the Egyptians. We backed a tyrant there for a long time. We somehow, I think, owe it to them to help them figure that out, and we need to be proactive about it, and we need to be sophisticated about it.
Well, you follow the events unfolding there through the thread of the Muslim Brotherhood. That is the strand that you keep watching. And it's been fascinating to watch how that group has sort of, in the beginning, finessed their position, gone on to take power, and then, you know, what's happened from there. But let's start with when you first came across the Muslim Brotherhood in those revolutionary days. What did the organization seem like then?
Well, you know, if I could, I'd back up even a little further, and I'd say, you know, Muslim Brotherhood's 80 years old. When I first came into Egypt, it was early 90s, 1993, right after the first World Trade Center bombing, when an Egyptian cleric, Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, inspired a small group that would be now looked upon as nascent al-Qaeda to try to take down the towers. They blew up the parking garage, if you remember. Six people were killed, but the towers remained standing. But their intent was to topple them. And that's when I first went to Egypt and first met the Muslim Brotherhood. They rejected violence. They embraced democracy, even though they were an underground movement. And that's what set them apart from Islamic Jihad and this emerging notion of al-Qaeda, which the Egyptian Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's now the head of al-Qaeda, was part of this split in Egypt. And that's a really important piece of history that I think a lot of people don't know. We tend to blur the lines that what's really the difference between Muslim Brotherhood and al-Qaeda. There's a profound difference. And one is that the Muslim Brotherhood have rejected violence and they have embraced democracy. And the al-Qaeda, as we all know, rejects democracy and embraces violence. To the point where they say that those Muslim Brotherhood members who believe that they can actually be democratically elected and allowed to rule are kidding themselves, that democracy is a front of the West. Now, you know, I certainly don't believe that, but it's important to know that that's a conversation on the street where al-Qaeda is saying to young men, mostly men, in the Muslim Brotherhood, you're foolish to believe in democracy. And I just think we need to be aware of that conversation and understand the importance of recognizing their adherence to democracy. Now, were they good leaders? Did they have good governance? I don't think anyone thinks they did. They were terrible. The Muslim Brotherhood forced through a constitution that was far too Islamist for most Egyptians' taste. They excluded women. They excluded the Christian minority. They did very little to protect the Christian minority.
Well, let's back up a little and have you tell me what role the Muslim Brotherhood played in that revolt against Hosni Mubarak.
I skipped over that. Yes, you're right. So during those days in Tahrir Square, the Muslim Brotherhood was really instrumental, I would argue, in combining forces with the youth movement, the Facebook generation. They came into it a little bit late, but when they did come into it, to those days on Tahrir Square, they came with great organizational skill. They were an underground movement for many years, and they brought their ability to organize to the revolution. And I think even the Facebook crowd would tell you they played a very big role in getting the numbers that led to the pressure that ultimately toppled Hosni Mubarak.
It's interesting. It's a complicated thing because they were part of the revolution. They were right up there on the bully pulpit when Mubarak was brought down. And yet there were many people interviewed in your documentary who said, well, at least I gave the impression that the Muslim Brotherhood was sort of hijacking the revolution and promoting things that they didn't believe in.
Yeah, again, thank you for watching it so carefully. That's a really good point. And the young man who we interviewed way back in 2011, you know, what he was professing was something that comes from what I would say is a relatively small secular elite. If you looked at him, he was wearing a tie-dye T-shirt, and he was in a very expensive tent. Remember, all the tents were set up in Tahrir Square?
Mm-hmm.
Most people who were young and poor like most Egyptians, just had plastic tarps and they have very old clothes. He is very much reflective of a part of Cairo that is elite. And I would say his concerns were genuine. And he said, I fear that they're hijacking our revolution. And there were definitely young people who feared that. But the vast majority of Egyptians are traditional. They have deep faith. And they respect the Muslim Brotherhood for toughing it out for 80 years. What they don't respect in the Muslim Brotherhood is what came in the next act, where, remember now, there were elections, the first free and fair elections in 5,000 years of Egyptian history. And the Muslim Brotherhood came to power in those parliamentary elections. They took 40% of parliament. And when you combine them with the other Islamist parties, they were more than two-thirds of the parliament. So a big expression from the voters of a belief that the Islamists should play a role in the future democracy of a new Egypt. But, like I was saying before when I got a bit ahead of myself, they failed. Their governance was not good. No one liked it. And so, after watching the Constitution pushed through, after watching many failures in the economy and elsewhere by the Muslim Brotherhood, and particularly giving too much power to the military, which is ironic now, of course, but the Muslim Brotherhood gave a lot of power to the military, really everything it wanted. And then suddenly people said, you know, we don't want this Muslim Brotherhood government. And an amazing show of popular support for overthrowing, or at least calling for early elections of Morsi, President Morsi, who came out of the Muslim Brotherhood political party. And did you watch those on television on June 30th when 20 million people took to the streets of Egypt and demanding that President Morsi, democratically elected, coming out of the Muslim Brotherhood, step down and call early elections because he was failing? So as many thoughtful Egyptians described this to me, it was an impeachment from the street, as one person put it.
No.
And, you know, that might be true, but it was also the military that moved in. So it also felt very much to Egyptians like a military coup.
What do you think, you know, we just got less than a minute before we stop to take a check of news, but was part of the problem with the Muslim Brotherhood at that moment in the leadership that they were too complicit with the army?
Yes, that was a deep concern. And there's this notion that we get at in the film of the deep state, that the military is really secretly controlling the economy. Some estimates as much as 40% of the private sector economy is controlled by the military. That they control the country, that they control the government. And it certainly seems the case. In the end of our film, as we assert, you know, it's very hard to see this any other way than the deep state, the military, is back in charge. And democracy and the road ahead remains something that's going to have to be defined in the future.
We are talking right now with Charles Sennett, Vice President and co-founder of Global Post and correspondent for Frontline's Egypt in Crisis. We'll keep on talking with him after we stop to check the state news. And if you'd like to weigh in on the topic we're discussing right now, you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickards.
And I'm Noah Avshinsky, and you're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.